This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
And action!
Hello and welcome to episode 394 of the Filmmakers Podcast. This is a podcast where we talk filmmaking, from indie film to studio films and everything in between. How to get them made, how to make them, and how to try not to royally F it up. In our very, very humble opinion. I'm Giles Alderson. I'm a writer, I'm a director, and I'm a producer. And I am really delighted to welcome onto today's show the director and writer, Zack Snyder. Yeah, that's right. The American film director, producer, and screenwriter, Zack Snyder. The director of Batman vs. Superman, Justice League, Man of Steel, Rebel Moon, and it's incredible. He sat down with Dom Lenoir and chatted all about his career and how he got Rebel Moon made, how he did it. Zack, he started off studying painting and shooting TV commercials, and, you know, and making anything he could get his hands on, which is pretty incredible. And it just goes to show you that we're in the same boat. Nothing changes. And then he made his first feature film, the 2004 remake of Dawn of the Dead, which made $102 million. It's still a lot. If I'd said pounds, you'd have still been impressed. But it's dollars. But then his second film, the 2006 historical war film 300, literally turbocharged his career. And like I say, went on to make Man of Steel, Batman vs. Superman, Justice League, and technically Zack Snyder's Justice League, as well as so many others as well that he's been involved in, from producing to screenwriting. And he's just an incredible guy. Everyone talks about him as a really cool guy. And he came across that way when myself and Dom chatted to him. We also obviously talk about Rebel Moon Part 2, The Scar Giver, which stars Sophia Boutella and Ed Skrein, who starred in Eddie Sternberg's I Used to Be Famous. Now, Eddie has been on the podcast and he's a friend of myself and Dom. So do go listen to that episode. I'll try and put a link in the show notes if I can. So not only have we got Zack Snyder on, but we've got Ed Skrein and Sophia Boutella as well. We'll start with Zack Snyder, because why not? It's Zack Bloomin' Snyder, who is a total legend. I also haven't mentioned Watchmen as well, which grossed over $185 million. The Legends of the Guardians as well, and Sucker Punch, which he also co-wrote and directed. Rebel Moon's on Netflix right now. Do go watch it. Thank you all so much for supporting this podcast and helping me get through dark times and times when I thought I should stop doing this. And yet you lot just seem to pipe up with some beautiful comment or how it inspired you to go make your films, or I get an email that says exactly that. And that's encouraging for me too, that this is helping in any way, shape or form. See, obviously it's great for me to chat to these people and for Dom to chat to these people and we get inspired, but sometimes, you know, can be a difficult business. And it can be really tough and lonely. And what's wonderful about, I feel, this podcast sometimes is it does bring people together. And when we see people, we chat, and people who've been on the podcast talk to other people. And I think that's lovely. And then doesn't feel so alone, because this industry can feel very much that way. And it's really important that you have persistence and resilience in this world of filmmaking, especially in the face of the challenges that we come across every day. And it's important that you keep pushing forward despite these setbacks, and every obstacle is an opportunity, really. And you've got to learn and grow from those, because maybe that film wasn't meant to be made, maybe that TV series wasn't the right one for you, and it would have taken you into a darker path and it wouldn't have worked at all. And how I feel that those kind of setbacks really do push you forward. And the same with creativity, you know, and your innovation. Please think outside the box. Please continue to do so and experiment with those new techniques when you get a chance. Even if it's with the iPhone, in the garden, you know, we talk about Matthew Butler Hart, Tori Butler Hart making feature films on the iPhone. You can do it too. and you can tell stories in unique ways. It's so important for your passion, your purpose, and I believe that the best films get made by those who are deeply passionate about their craft and are committed to telling those meaningful stories, which we can all do. So do encourage other filmmakers around you to network. Do encourage them to collaborate and lift each other up on that journey. And if you see someone struggling or hasn't posted for a while or you haven't seen for a while, maybe send them a message and go, how are you doing? You all right? Just checking in. Because it can, like I say, it can be lonely and it can be dark and it can be difficult when other people are working, making things happen and you're not. So believe in yourself. It's so important. I want you to have that confidence in your own ability. And trust your instincts, right? Never doubt your potential that you can succeed in this business. And you can. So without further ado, I'm going to pop in after the Zack Snyder episode anyway. Dom is filming at the moment, so he couldn't do the intro. But this is myself and Dom Lenoir chatting to the amazing Zack Snyder.
You and I fighting together.
You must know you cannot win.
You're all here. Because there is nothing to return to. Dark days lie ahead of us all. We will teach you how to fight. That's impressive. The Scargivers among them. Those this village holds most dear. I shall destroy them.
I have no choice but to fight.
The Scargiver herself.
Go, 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 go!
Are you truly prepared to allow this to continue in your name?
How are you doing, Zach?
Doing great. How are you doing?
Very good. Yes, very good. I was very excited to look at part two of Rebel Moon. I mean, what an ambitious, exciting franchise. And I think the most exciting thing for me was finding out that you'd kind of masterminded it from, well, not from a book, basically. It's such a broad and expansive world to sort of come up with. Can you talk about how that sort of came about?
Yeah, you know, I have a great and kind of deep interest in mythology and a deep interest in I love sci-fi fantasy. And I just felt like part of the reason why we just were like, let's just do it from scratch was that it also, and I think that it will become more obvious when you see the director's cuts, but you know, I also wanted to kind of like have a little bit of fun with the genre that I feel like, and by fun, I mean like sort of be able to like push it into like, whether it be sexuality or violence or, you know, mythology, all the like weirdness, which of course, you know, you get a little teeny taste of in the PG-13, but I think, and so I think the PG-13 really represents the sort of what I would say is the more earnest kind of, you know, kind of down the middle version of the movie, which is fun to watch and really exciting. And then later on, you'll get the like weirdo kind of deconstructed version of that. But that was kind of the why of it when I really wrote it at the beginning, was just because I wanted, there was a bunch of stuff I wanted to see that was crazy. And so I was like, let's do that, you know.
I mean, did you have to scale it back once you'd come up with the original ideas? Because, I mean, you know, with your imagination, when you're especially going into sort of sci-fi world, you can try and do so many things that are wildly ambitious and wildly expensive. I mean, how was the writing process? Was it kind of come up with the first part?
There was a few gags that we just couldn't, that were too big, but not that many, you know, because the story is pretty straightforward when you really think about it, when you really boil it down, you know, we're like, oh, we're there in the village, the bad guys come, the bad guys leave, we decide to go get guys, we go out, we get them, we come back, the bad guys come back, we fight them.
Yeah, sort of classic storytelling. I mean, I suppose, you know, you're very well known for your stylistic approach. And I think that's something that our audience, because we're a filmmaking podcast, and that's something our audience is really excited by.
Sure.
At what stage are you, I mean, how do you even start to put together your first draft of a script? I mean, I'm guessing it is a director's script in a sense that you're really setting all the tone and the world building and that kind of thing. I mean, do you think about the world in detail? Do you do sort of small treatments and then just get stuck into the, you know, into the script? Like, how does that process sort of come about for you?
Yeah, we tend to whiteboard the movie pretty extensively. And pretty detailed as far as the scenes go and the character breakdown and all that. That's really the main work we do right away. I normally write the beginning and the end of the movie.
Okay.
And in the R-rated version of the movie, I wrote up to granary to the granary fight, you know, and that was like my initial, that was like the initial movie, right? Like when I was pitching it to Kurt's been kind of hearing about it and kind of working on the story with me for a long time. And, you know, it's like one of those things where you talk about the ideas and stories, we talk about them. And then one day I just kind of wrote it down and I said, what do you think? And then he was like, that's cool. And then when I got Kurt and Shay involved, I kind of had that as sort of a pitch, like to say, like, this is the tone. And that also included this 20-minute sequence that's not even in the PG-13 that opens the movie in the R-rated version. So so when you read that, I think when you read from there to, it's like 40 pages. So like you have 40 pages and you're like, okay, I got it. Like, this is the movie. And that also, I think, allowed all of us to be really in the tone, you know? And then I wrote kind of out the, you know, the end, like, you know, sort of the end battle between Cora and Noble. And then there's actually another scene at the very end that's not in this version even.
I mean, you're kind of well known for your director's cuts. And I think that's, you know, it's actually a great thing, because you're catering for two audiences at the same time. So you're keeping the film fans happy and you're also keeping whoever's distributing it happy. Was Netflix an instinctual sort of choice for this? I mean, I suppose to give you the freedom as well to explore a new IP.
It's an 100%. They've been incredibly great partners, and just really like, I mean, this is some brand new IP. It's completely original, you know. Like, was it 200? Like, I feel like I gave them, I think, a 225 page script to start. You know, that was, they were just
not
like,
sure what to read.
Yeah, and so then the whole thing was like, oh, let's turn it into two movies. We just kind of, instead of trimming it, because that was the original idea, was like, oh, just trim it. And then I was like, I can't. And so then we just broke it in half. And I think that in my mind, it worked out really incredibly well because, you know, you get this, like, if you watch the movies back to back, it's like a nice 4-hour immersion sort of experience, epic. You know?
Yeah. And was that a conscious choice to not sort of split it into hour long episodic, you know, that kind of format? And I think it works very well as having a sort of a grand experience by doing it the way you've done. But it's just, it's interesting to think about.
Yeah, I feel like, sure. I think it was. I think the idea was like to, you know, I was developing it with the movie side. And I think, you know, to them, the idea of like creating two-hour movies that kind of, the other sort of experiment was like the sort of really close release window to see like, because we shot the movies together, so we could just go bang, bang. And like, you know, while you're still kind of remembering Rebel Moon, you get another Rebel Moon. And then when we release the director's cuts, those both are going to drop on the same day.
Oh, nice.
Like, so it'll be like a 6-hour drop on the same day. You know, it's two, three hour movies, you know? So we'll see how, like, it'd be interesting for people to experience it that way as well. I've always wanted the window to be tighter than what we've done, but it's still way earlier than a normal sequel, of course, than, you know.
And what was the sort of creative collaboration with Netflix? I mean, obviously you're an extremely well-known director. You've got a very distinct style. Obviously you've got a proven track record. Was there any sort of thoughts of, okay, you know, we love this, but, you know, maybe this would really help us in how we're packaging?
By the way, that's the relationship with every movie studio. I don't know if you, no matter who the director is, there's no world where you show the movie and you get notes and you talk about, you know, a lot of it is to length. You know, they really wanted the movies to be close to 2 hours. So that was a big driver. And also PG-13 and really accessible, because it's like, it was an experience. And I wanted I agreed that we should have a kind of really broad audience experience, you know, that everybody could enjoy. That wasn't for kids, but kids, you know, not kids, whatever, younger adults could enjoy it. And so a lot of the notes went to that, because we were really working off this very hard R-rated, super long movie. That was the sort of thing that was the template. So, you know, but the nice thing about them was they were like, okay, we're working over here kind of to sculpt these two movies, using them as great partners and great sounding boards. And then meanwhile, over here, they're like, you can make your movie with no notes and no anything and just do whatever the fuck you want. So that was a cool, for me, that I've never had that experience. You know, I don't know if any filmmaker has, like, you know, to have this, to be running four movies at the same time, because I don't consider the director's cuts to be extended versions. They are alternate universe, alternate reality versions of these movies, because there's a lot of stuff that happens in those movies that doesn't happen in PG-13. There's some things that happen in PG-13 that don't happen in the R-rated version. You know, it's a really interesting, like, right now we're running two parallel universes next to each other. A lot of things do cross over, of course, but they're also completely weirdly separate kind of concepts.
Does that mean you have to kind of shoot specific material for one that doesn't sort of necessarily go into the other?
Correct.
Yes. Yep. And you're thinking about very that all the way through the sort of budgeting.
Yeah, there's some lines of dialogue that are different. There's like everything is very there. We went so far in the weeds that there's a take. There'd be like the actor would do a take of the same dialogue. And I'd be like, that's for the R-rated, that's for the PG-13. Like, even though it's the same take, and they're like, I just said the same words, you know, and you might be like, and when you watch, you're like, oh, that scene was exactly the same, but it was in PG-13. I'd be like, well, actually, the third take, that monologue is actually, the second take is in PG-13 and the fourth take is in the R-rated.
I mean, that's an incredible amount of detail to be thinking of. It's brilliant.
Yeah. So, it's crazy. But we... And I'll say that the experience is so I think as a experience, sort of cinematic experience, it's really one doesn't negate the other, I think, which is a really interesting thing. Like, you know, I would say that in my experience, a lot of times I find the director's cuts of my movies are the director's cuts. And so by definition, they sort of cancel the theatrical version or whatever you want to call it. They just from a sort of filmmaker standpoint. Now, in this case, because it's sort of the alternate reality version sort of mentality, I don't feel the same way. I feel like the PG-13 is its own experience and that's cool. And, you know, I'm excited for people to go on that journey, but I feel like then the sort of that those movies, they're actually have different titles than the PG-13. Like the names of the movies, this Rebel Moon, you know, part one and then a different name rather than Scargiver or Child of Fire. You know what I mean? It's like they have they have different names. But so that's what I mean by like you. It's a cool. I feel like we set up a smart machine to produce all these movies. But from a filmmaking standpoint, it was quite. We got in the groove with it pretty amazingly. So it was fun. Because my script supervisor was not happy. She was the most. She was the most
working very hard
because yeah. She had to track everything for the tuber. Like, oh, you got to make sure they have to say that dialogue for PG-13 now. Make sure they say, you know, they can't say fuck every 5 minutes. They got to like now. So, yeah. So there was a lot of that.
Very cool. Just welcoming Giles. He's my colleague on the podcast.
Oh, awesome.
Hello, mate.
Yeah, we haven't talked about pre-production or casting yet. If you want to jump in, Joss.
Yeah, pre-production must be a fascinating time for you. Then, do you like how busy is that for you? Because for most people, it's devising everything, you know, in terms of this going through the script, your storyboard. What about you? How do you work in that period? Do you love that period? Do you prefer being on set? But mainly, what is your process in pre-production?
Yeah, I'm drawing pretty much the entire prep of the movie. It takes me about 5 months. To draw a normal movie, and this one being, you know, 6 hours. What was essentially we shot 6 hours of content. The drawing process was insane, more than I've ever done. I think I drew 3,000 frames or something crazy like that for this. And so it was a lot of work. And then in the meantime, like pretty much all the weekends and nights, I'm drawing, and then the rest of the time, you know, we're scouting and drawing and also I built all the lenses for the movie were completely bespoke and custom made for the film, and they the process of building the lenses, which I created with Zero Optic, was insane and like completely, we went down the deepest rabbit holes, anamorphic rabbit holes in history. Not in history, I'm sure other people have done it, but for me, it was like crazy. So that was really also an adventure, sort of my cinematographer's hat side of me was very busy as well. So yeah, there's a lot to do, but it was really, I had an amazing time making the movie. We shot it here in LA. It was the first movie I've ever shot in Los Angeles. So it was nice to be able to go home at night and stuff, because every single movie we've shot somewhere else.
What are some of the challenges of shooting in LA?
The challenges of shooting in LA are, one, that your life continues. Normally when you go on location, like when we, like for instance, for Justice League, we moved to England, right? And we lived, in Chipperfield and in the country, and it was like lovely, but we also didn't have our normal lives. So we really were just moving. It's like circus time, right? Like you join the circus and you go, and then everything you do is, you know, for the movie. But when you shoot at home, you know, you still have to like the dogs go, you know, the kids got to go to school. You know, it's like, it becomes like, you know, it's weirdly, it's a little bit harder, actually, to be honest, even though it's more comfortable to be in your own house with all your clothes and your bed and like your normal lives. But it's better for the kids because they don't get, you know, as disrupted. You know, they got teeny English accents when they were living in England.
Oh, that's cute.
They'd be like, Daddy, do you think the leaves will fall in autumn? And I'm like, what? we have to put on our jumpers, and I'd be like, jumpers, where are jumpers?
jumpers. Are you able to differentiate when you're on set as going home at night? Because sometimes when you go home at night, like you say, your kids are there, and when you're on location filming, you're just concentrating on filming. Everything's about that moment. But yeah, Suddenly now you've got family and home life to deal with. Is that okay for you to juggle?
It's fine. I mean, and also don't forget, my wife is my producer. So she also has the same, we have the same, you know, all of our troubles on set, they just come home. You know, it's like, hey, I mean, I think in that way it works, because we both have the same.
Okay.
When I get home, it's not like she's more likely to have to get on the phone and be like, we put out a fire. you know, like, oh, the wheat's not growing or the set's, you know, not going to be done or whatever. She's the one having to deal with that. And I'm like, okay, well, let me know what, like, if we're filming that tomorrow, because I don't know, like, I'm ready to shoot that. And she's like, well, the wheat's not going to be ready, so we can't shoot. You know, like, these are the conversations we have at night, you know, when we're at home.
What were some of the challenges of shooting this? I mean, the biggest challenge, obviously, there's a lot of challenges. And also that mix between using real assets and CGI and how you sort of combine that.
Yeah, we built a lot of practical sets for this movie. There's a lot of giant, the Veltian village, you know, that we built up here just north of Los Angeles. That was a really immersive set with the gigantic... you know, village, the longhouse, and all the interiors were practical. So all that stuff, like, we built for real. I think probably the biggest challenge was really dealing with the harvesting. The wheat was the biggest crazy challenge, because we planted all that wheat. We had it on the circuit. We had hired these farmers that told us when the wheat would be ready. The wheat, of course, was not ready. Apparently our soil was not as, didn't have the nutrients that they thought it would have. And so the soil, the wheat didn't grow as fast as it was supposed to. So it was like 3 weeks behind.
Real farmer problems.
Well, yeah, all farmer problems, you know. And production, you know, movie production really isn't on the same schedule as sort of the natural world, you know, with, you know, like, oh, it didn't rain, or it rained. Actually, we had a really wet spring. And so it kind of pushed, actually, the wheat could live longer. That's one of these things that I didn't know. I thought that we would have, that we would ripen faster, but it doesn't. That's not how it works. So these are things I learned. But yeah, so that was like a really crazy. So we had to build all these sets super fast and pull up the schedule and do all these crazy things that, you know, you don't, no one teaches you that in film school, that you're also going to be a farmer.
Yeah. What's been the challenges of your filmmaking career that would help our listeners? The things that people don't necessarily tell you, you know, what the things that people tell you to say are the things you should do, but actually sometimes it's the opposite.
Yeah, it's a great question. I guess it's been my experience so far that, you know, there's a real fine line and a really interesting sort of philosophical question about, like, what is, you know, like, to create a piece of entertainment that's purpose is to entertain, right? And the line is between your sort of basic instincts in storytelling, right? Because, you know, a story entertains when it's immersive, right? Like when you are like seduced by the characters and you're on the ride, you don't even realize you're being entertained, right? It's happening to you. I feel like sometimes when you're conscious of the movie's attempts to entertain you, you kind of get mad. You get turned off by that. You know, it's like a weird relationship. You know, don't love me to, like, let me fall in love with you. You know, it's like, and so I think that what I've learned is that, and I think the most important lesson is that your sort of natural instincts in regard to what you find entertaining, and that might sometimes be being more provocative, being more, you know, not trying to make your story entertaining, but making it compelling to you, is probably the primary goal of being a filmmaker. Is that if you are interested in the characters or the scenarios in a way that you can't stop thinking about it, or it's you have to figure out what to do next and all that, then it will be that for the audience. And I think that to second guess and or to take on, it's always important to understand the, like, story structure, three-act structure, blah, 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 character development, all the things from a technical standpoint. You know, you have to know the rules before you can break them, all that. But I would say is that, you know, probably your favorite movies, like when you really think about what movies were compelling to you or what movies really got you, for me anyway, it tends to be the ones where I feel the sort of the personality and or the hand of the filmmaker. Lee, I don't feel like no one put it to the committee. You know, I feel like these choices are very personal that I'm feeling, right? And the personal choices, to me, tend to be more compelling because they are unexpected or they are, you know, they are unique. And I think through that, I would say you're, as a young filmmaker or a budding filmmaker, it's important just to really be true to your personal voice. And because that's the thing that no one else can do. You can't, you know, the AI could write you a movie that's probably pretty well, like, structured, but you are going to do something weird that no one's going to do. And that's what I want to see. You know, I want the weirdness.
And I think that's what makes you such a successful filmmaker. Zach, we've got to let you go. But best of luck with the whole franchise and, you know, you keep making amazing, unique, brilliant personal works. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you guys. Really appreciate it.
Zack Snyder there, everyone, on the Filmmakers Podcast. We've had some amazing guests, especially in the last sort of 6 months. I mean, all our guests are amazing. Don't get me wrong. If you're listening and you've been on, you're all amazing. But in the last 6 months, particularly, like, we've had so many relentlessly amazing guests. David Ayer, who else? Thea Sharrock, Issa Lopez, Reinaldo Marcus Green, Nikolai Arcel, Matthew Vaughn, Grant Heslov, J.A. Boyena of the Oppenheimer team, George C. Wolfe. These are all Oscar-nominated people. And James Hawes, who did One Life and Slow Horses. And now I've got Zack Snyder, and I feel very privileged and honoured to share all those with you. And this is for free, by the way. You get it for free. So if there's something you don't like, shut up. But the things you do like, do tell your friends. It really is important, because that's why we keep doing it, to help. So if you're just in passing talking about filmmaking, do pass on the Filmmakers Podcast and say, hey, yeah, there is some good episodes. That'd be really nice. So next up, we have Ed Skrein and Sophie Patella. Ed Skrein, he is, like I say, not only starred in Eddie Steinberg's I Used to Be Famous, but also in Deadpool. And I imagine he might be back. Maybe not in Deadpool. Who knows? He's also in the Transporter Refueled series. He's in the film Midway. He's in, obviously, Rebel Moon Part 1. And now he's in Rebel Moon Part 2, The Scar Giver. And he started out doing a movie called Piggy, Ill Manners, The Sweeney, all those brilliant UK indie films. And he's built his way up through the Transporter series to Deadpool. And now is absolutely flying high, and good for him, because he's a really lovely guy as well in Rebel Moon. And also Sophia Patella, you'll know her from Kingsman Secret Service. She's just incredible in those films. She's pretty much incredible in everything I've seen her in. The Mummy, she's brilliant in that film. She's also in Star Trek Beyond, as well as Rebel Moon Episode 1, and now Episode 2, of course. But she also has starred in Fahrenheit 451, Hotel Artemis, Atomic Blonde, and Rogue Heroes on TV as well. So, this is Sophia Patella and Ed Skrein chatting with Dom Lemoire all about Rebel Moon and lots of other little cool things as well.
Welcome to the Filmmakers Podcast.
Thank you.
I've actually got a friend of yours, Eddie Steinberg, who's a friend of ours as well. With you, I Used to Be Famous.
Yeah, so, I love Eddie.
Congratulations on that as
well. He's the better Eddie.
The better Eddie, okay. Maybe parallel Eddies.
Yeah, well.
Anyway, how are you doing? Welcome to England.
Thank you very much. It's nice to be here.
Are you, what's the reception so far? Are you buzzed to be releasing the second part? I mean, it's such an action epic, and it's got so much emotion in it as well. I managed to watch it a couple of days ago, and I was thoroughly excited. I mean, how are you sort of dealing with all of that?
Yeah, I mean, it's really interesting, the process of filmmaking, you know, and the preparation, the shoot, you know, it's so intense. It's so labor intensive. It's so intense when you're kind of like really living the state of beings of each scene. And, you know, this one was so prolonged over 7.5 months.
Wow.
So much training, so much stunt, so much dialogue to learn, and you know, so many different, so much of an arc for Noble, so much to work on and prepare, that it was really kind of overwhelming in that regard. And I really throw myself into things. So when you finish, then you kind of begin the process of kind of rebuilding yourself into being a super villain.
Yeah.
Yeah, precisely. And, you know, coming back to Hackney and, you know, back to the school run. And back to, you know, real life and kind of physically, spiritually, emotionally rebuilding from it and kind of purging as well, you know, not just for, you know, partly from an acting point of view of, you know, okay, we've done that, move that aside. Next time I play even an antagonist, it will be something different. So let's, you know, let's get rid of that. And also from a human point of view, like I really want to leave behind this kind of, you know, the sadism and the horror of playing noble. So then, you know, fast forward a year, I've lived my normal life for a year. I'm a completely different person. I'm completely back to being Ed again. Part one comes out and it's like, okay, all right, well, let me see it first of all. And even then it's a objective analysis on the process of filmmaking, the process of preparing a character, the process of executing a character, of giving range in the edit and such, and decision making. And you watch the movie and you say, well, how successful was I in that decision making? But I'm still looking at it, you know, my friends and my missus and my family, they'll say I'm harsh, but I'm objective. When things are good, I'll say it's good, and I don't think I'm blowing up my own trumpet when I do that. And, you know, so I'll look at it objectively, decide what I could do well and could do better, and how that will change things going forward. Now, that's different from how I may feel about the project as a whole. I'm talking about my analysis of me. Now, my analysis of a project of a whole, for me, I understand that when I'm deep inside it, I'm lost in it. I can't judge this as a whole. Yeah. Like, I really have no idea what this is as a whole. So it's really interesting to see the reactions that humans come up and have with me, the digital reactions that I may see, you know, that come up on your algorithm or whatever, and vice versa, to hear that those things. So then even more interesting to have two parts of this, and then even we're going to have the Snyder Cut version as well. So this whole process is, I find it really interesting. It's part of the game. And I also have an intention to try and enjoy each part of the game as much as I can. And, you know, feeling very proud of the work I've done on it, feeling like the work that my intentions did translate, means that I can kind of just sit back with popcorn and say, oh, really? That's how you felt about it? Oh, okay. Oh, well, let's see with this one and that one. And so it is quite fun.
Mm-hmm.
But it's really interesting because, you know, you do somewhat feel removed from it.
Yeah.
And it's really weird because no one except kind of Zach and Sophia and these guys is as deep in it as I am. But I feel removed from it. Yeah. So it's really interesting to be asked questions about it. Questions about the process, 1,000,000%. I know that I'm still in there because I keep that with me because I'm going to need that for next time.
Mm.
But the actual movie is I find it hard to judge.
Well, let's go into the process because I'm really interested. I mean, you've touched upon playing villains before. Obviously, you're very well known for the Deadpool villain. When the script first comes through or you get the call from Zack Snyder or his team or whatever, what's your thoughts in terms of how I can make this villain different, how I can make it my own, what's on the script? I mean, what was your sort of first impressions about building those kind of choices and that multifaceted character?
Mm-hmm. How interesting. So my intention is pretty much to make movies like I used to be famous. To make movies like If Beale Street Could Talk, Mona Lisa and the Blood Moon. Like, this is the realm that I exist and want to exist in. Then you have this fact that I love training martial arts. And after like working on martial arts from like 2020 up until we're working really hard over COVID and stuff, I was getting to the end of 2021. I was saying to my trainer, Yusuf Ali Talib, I was saying like, I want something physical. I'm ready again. I'm ready to go back into something big and crazy and do and put this work in. But I'm very careful and reticent to take antagonist roles.
Mm.
Kind of for the reason of exactly what happens when this movie comes out is it's like, hey, you're the big bad guy, you know? You're always the bad guy. I'm like, okay.
Not always.
I think that they're very memorable.
I know, yeah. It's true.
And Zapan was memorable in Alita. And, you know, I think that And especially Ajax, you know, people always go back to that. So I think they're memorable, and because they're such kind of big commercial pieces, people are going to see that more than they're going to see I Used to Be Famous or Mona Lisa and the Blood Moon. I am reticent to play these antagonists. So therefore, what was it that made me step into this?
Was it okay, it's a Zach film, I want to work with Zach? Mm-hmm. Was there something on the page where you thought, I can make some really interesting decisions here as an actor? And sort of, because I mean, it does feel, you know, you bring all of your roles feel like a very unique set of choices. And I think that is why they're memorable, because otherwise they would just be carbon sort of cut out villains.
Precisely.
So
it's nice to hear you say that, because that was my intention and is my intention. And it would be very, it would be very successful at my job if I just came in and played it the same, with the same accent, the same body language, the same emotions. Partly, yes, Zach.
Yeah.
You know, I've been so lucky in my career that I've been able to work with Robert Rodriguez, Roland Emmerich, Barry Jenkins, you know, Tim Miller, all these different kind of people at such extremes on the kaleidoscope of filmmaking. And really it's my intention to continue doing that, you know, and to be working with the Eddie Sternbergs and everything, and Anna Lily Amnipour in between. You know, this is like the privilege of my job, is to learn from these creatives, and I truly do learn from them. I'm watching, I'm studying, analyzing, and after the fact I'm thinking about the decisions they made. And when I watch the movie, I'm not thinking binary, is it good, is it bad, box office means nothing to me. No, Zach's decisions are interesting, you know, so I can be a better judge in the future, be a better actor, and be a better director and writer in the future as well. So yes, to work with Zach is truly part of it, but really it was the fact that, way more so than any antagonist I've ever played before, look at the service this guy gets. I mean, he's like the lead character in that he gets the arc and all of that. In fact, there's so much sort of ambiguity to Cora's character that perhaps her arc isn't, there isn't so much arc to the protagonist in this story, which is actually quite specific to Zack Snyder movies as well, that he serves his villain so well.
Yeah.
So I couldn't believe that when I read it. When I read it, I was like, this Noble is, this is the best character in it. This is crazy. And then every day on set, I think, God, I really have got the most fun. I've got, you know, this is easily the most fun anyone's having. Yes, it got tough. It was difficult endurance-wise and all of that. But in terms of the actual acting that was required of me, the opportunities to show different flavors and different states of being, I couldn't believe how well it was serviced. I've never had an antagonist that had such a such ups and downs.
eBay Motors is here for the ride. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly. Brake kits, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time. Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only, exclusions apply.
I mean, what were some of the conversations you had with Zach about the character? Were there any moments where you discussed things and you thought, this would really help me prepare if we tweaked this line or this little moment here? Was it just sort of getting to know the background of the character, or was it just this sort of psychological discussions about his mindset and where he was coming from, where he was going?
So Zach, as well as being like the nicest, most beautiful human being in the world, is a encyclopedia of knowledge. And of course, this is his story. So what was fascinating was the first Zoom that we did, which I think was only about 45 minutes, an hour, I wrote 6 pages of like crazy scribbles. And when I go back to them, that's the foundation of all of my stuff.
Right.
It really is. Like, it was all there from the beginning. But what he was giving me, to your question, is backstory, is his intentions, how he feels, stuff that me and my acting coach would have to work on for ages, or I'd have to get halfway through the shoot and go, oh, it's about impressing his dad. It's all about that. He just wants to get back to the Senate and impress his dad because he's this, you know, kind of disappointment to the nobility. So he gave me that. And then after that, it's on set, how was it with Zach? Well, Zach would give me a lot of jurisdiction with lines, and he'd let me make suggestions. I'm a big believer in first and foremost saying what's on the page and really trying to make that work.
So making the connection in your own mind of how you get there rather than changing
precisely,
the lines.
Yeah. Precisely. And like my main job is to be a vessel for the director, the screenwriter and the editor. That is my job. My job is not to shine. My job is to service the hierarchy of the characters that have been written. And if I do that, I will shine, you know? And so he did give me that jurisdiction. And things like, you know, at the end of part one, when she knocks my teeth out.
Yes.
And I look up at her and I say, this is perfect. Well, I was there with Zach and we were in between and we'd done a couple of takes of it. And then I said to him, you know what? Because he told me Noble's a sexual deviant in that first Zoom. And that was so informative as well. Even though there's only kind of one scene that alludes to sex in the whole thing in the bedchambers, that really helped everything the way I spoke to them.
And I think that's what feels so original and exciting in that kind of...
But even in that, I said to him, you know what I'm going to do is I'm just going to look up. I'm going to look up like, yeah, this is perfect. And he was like, say that. And I was like, say it? No, I was just going to look it like, you know, I'm an actor. I'm going to say it with my eyes. It's like, nah, say it. Like, okay, cool. Said it. And when I watched the movie, I'm like, huh, that really worked. And it spoke to that Noble's nature. So, yeah, it was collaborative in that way. Other interesting things is like in the first scene that I shot, which was on Gondival Moon in part one, when I have all of the characters lined up, believe it or not, that was my first scene.
Wow.
And when I come out, my character says, who all have we got here then? And I read it and I said to Zach, I said, is this a typo? Because is this an American writing English?
Yeah.
Or is this just a typo? Or is this supposed to be something unique to how he speaks? Obviously, I didn't kind of have a complete handle on his speech at that point. And if you go back, you'll notice that I don't speak in that kind of Olivia Colman style so much in that first scene. I don't have the same music to my voice there that I do for the rest of the movie, because it took me a couple of days.
It starts to inform it and then...
Precisely. And then I found it and it's like, okay, now. And then it's like, we're going to go deep into it.
Mm.
So I said to him, which one is it? And he said, I don't know. I think it's probably a typo. What do you want to do? And I was like, nah, it's weird as fuck. Let's do it.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's like, I come out and, well, who all have we got here? And it's just like, geez. And so again, it's like, this is the funnest, the best part of this is the process.
Mm.
And it's why like the binary notions of good or bad or success and failure, you know, it's got nothing to do with me. The process is the fascinating part, is the obstacle, is the path. This feels weird. This line feels clunky. It doesn't feel right. I don't speak like that. That's what actors say. I would never say that.
Yeah.
My character would never say that. Well, let's...
But what if you did?
Yeah, but what if you made it work?
Yeah.
Or you know. So, Zach's kind of like the dream tango partner for that kind of dance, the process of dance. And, you know, much like all the best directors I work with, he'll make you think it was your idea. And it was his.
Yeah. Or maybe it was a mixture.
I'm sure it was a mixture.
So just as a quick thing, if people are sort of sending you scripts, you know, because we've got a filmmaking audience, what is it that you look for? I mean, obviously, Zack Snyder, interesting characters. I mean, that's certainly one thing that's going to be very tantalizing. But what is it that you see in scripts that doesn't interest you, like common mistakes? And what are the sort of things, maybe characteristics, that get you excited?
I'm not interested in generic characters whatsoever, from top to bottom. Certainly for the characters that I take on, but really even in the pieces, and I kind of find it frustrating, even if I'm kind of like the only character that's not formulaic, being around them on set, but also watching it. So that kind of informs me somewhat in decision-making. Is it something that I've done in the past? And again, it's not as binary as protagonist, antagonist, you know, school teacher, cop. No, is this something new? Also, it has to challenge me. I've got to be a little bit scared by it. I've got to feel those nerves that I used to feel like when I was going to my swimming galas when I was a kid and just like, ah, oh, I'm a bit nervous. Like, I have faith in my own ability, but the whole car ride there, I'm like, man, I've got to be at my best for this. And it's the same thing. I want to be in the car. I want to wake up in the morning like, okay, today's the day. I've got to do that thing, you know, and just kind of have that kind of nervous energy. Truth is like the pretentious,
yeah,
but true answer. I want to see real, honest human emotion.
Mm.
I suppose that goes back to the first part of the answer, which is, you know, that
it can't feel generic. It has to feel real.
It can't feel generic. I want to see real human emotion. And if I achieve anything in my work, I hope that's what people feel. And also when I'm doing big action movies, I'd like people to say, oh, that guy grounds them. That guy brings them to real human emotion, even though they're in space, even though there's aliens and all of this. I feel grounded by this person's performance, that this person's performance sits in real, honest human emotion. Because really, if you boil my job down, then that's what my job is.
Perfect advice to end on. Thanks, Ed. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Man. Thank you.
Really good.
I wish everyone asked questions like
thank you.
Like you, man.
Is that, are we still filming? Welcome to the Filmmakers Podcast, Sophia.
Thank you. Hi.
Massive congratulations on the second part of Rebel Moon.
Thank you.
I mean, the first one was impressive, but the second one hits all kinds of emotional notes that were really impressive and unexpected. Like, I wasn't expecting to go on such a journey. So,
what were you surprised by?
I think just the amount of, you know, in a science fiction, to be caught off guard by the level of chemistry with the actors, like with you and your partner. I mean, it really caught me by surprise in a good way.
That's good.
And I mean, you don't always get that from sci-fi, I think.
No, so. You don't, especially from that kind of level action film. Mm. Getting that kind of, I mean, I think it needed that softness and that romance.
Yeah.
Well, I'm excited, you know, for people to discover the full story that was intended to begin with, because the script, I mean, part one and two, I mean, it was written as one script and it was meant to be one film and not have a pause in between. And it's nice to see the relationships and be more intimate with the character and see what is drawing them to want to fight for that cause.
So what was it that first attracted you to the project? How did you hear about this? Was it a call from Zach's team?
No, I got a call from my agent and I taped for it. And then I went in and I spoke with Zach for about 3 hours. He gave me the whole story in detail, by the way, because I didn't have the script at the time and I just was sent scenes. And then we did a screen test, which was a full-on day of filming, basically. And I got the part after that. But I thought, you know, how can I not say yes to working with Zach, first of all. I just, you know, he's a master at his craft. He knows so well what he's doing, and how can I resist being in slow-mo, basically?
Yeah.
But no, it's just, I thought it would be just really fun to be part of an original story. And I haven't done action stunts, and I haven't done any fight in a long time at that point. So I thought it would be the right project to do it for, and doing it with Zach, I knew he was going to shoot it in an amazing way. And yeah.
Because you've done some really good action in the past, but this has obviously got a really good mixture.
Yeah.
I mean, what was it, in terms of the drama, was that something that really excited you as well? Because, I mean, there is some very good interpersonal sort of connections.
Yeah.
There's a romance. There's a lot of sacrifice. There's a lot to sort of delve into. You know, when you were looking at that script for the first time, what were the sort of things going on in your brain about how to build the character?
Yeah, no, when I was reading, I was like, okay, that's heavy shit.
Mm.
It's not just your go-to story or like your predictable kind of like storyline. It's really intense. And he gave us things that are really hard to overcome as characters, which makes it fun for an actor, because I don't feel like I've seen, I couldn't copy and paste from other stories, whether it's Nemesis story or Cora story. And I remember I can't say so many spoilers, I think, but there's the one thing that Cora goes through that you discover in movie number two about her, some of part of her responsibilities when she was part of the mother world, that was quite heavy. And I did not know how to relate to it, how to defend it, having to be the lawyer of your character. I did not know where to grab it from. And that was hard to juggle. And then I forgave her and I understood, okay, like I know how to be the lawyer to her. I get it. But it was hard. It was not obvious.
I think that's one of the really fascinating things about your character is this sort of sense of guilt that she carries that isn't obviously understood until quite a long way into the second film, like where it's all sort of coming from. But there's this
why she's such a recluse, or why she's so quiet, and why can't she? I mean, it's literally the second scene or third scene in movie one that is quite heavy with Hagen, who asks where I tell him I don't to be loved or love or to be loved. I don't know what that is. Basically, I don't know if I'm capable of either. And she was taught that love is weakness, which is quite heavy from the beginning. Mm. And I think it pays off in movie number two that you understand where she comes from and that journey to even wear a dress and have slight longer hair and being a bit softer with the world around her.
What did you personally relate to that you were able to bring into the film outside of the script and Zach's sort of thoughts as well?
It's something that actually came quite early on because I was waiting to hear back from the tape, and then I got the part, and I wrote a letter to Zach just to tell him how I truly felt about the character, and what I knew I could bring is basically the fact that I understand what it feels like to feel like you don't belong somewhere and feel that awkwardness. And I grew up through a war in Algeria, a civil war in Algeria, not a war, but a civil war, which is like really damaging to a population and long time creates more long time repercussion that, you know, makes it very hard for a country to get back on their feet, But I felt like I understood that and I wrote that to him and I thought that this is what Cora is, basically. She had to escape.
What was maybe the hardest bit about your character that you had to sort of grapple with?
It's what happens in movie number two.
Yeah, of course, we find out
about her past story.
Yeah, that was
the hardest part for me emotionally because I did not know what to do with it. I did not. I couldn't find it in any other piece of literature or piece of another film. And I didn't grab anything from outside, by the way. I stayed centered with the script and Zach and what I could lift off the page, you know, that was interesting to explore, but I tried to make it as authentic and original as possible.
And how do you sort of approach the stunt side of things and the action? Because I mean, there's so much action and it's all, you know, I mean, you can definitely see in a lot of the wide shots that you're doing, you know, a fair amount of it. So, I mean, what were some of the challenges of that side of things and prepping for that on such a big movie? And it was 7 months, wasn't it? Or something like that?
Ten months.
So, I mean, a really long year shoot.
Of prep. Yeah. That's just for me. Zach is even longer. He's still working on it. But I think, you know, yeah, I sort of copy and paste the formula of approaching stunt choreography from what I did when I was a dancer. I look at it as just being the same exact, and I discovered that quite early on because when I got Kingsman, I had no idea that I could do stunts to begin with because it was my first time doing it or doing any fight training. But I thought, okay, I need to adapt it the same way. Then I look at dance and do exactly what I've learned there, except it's not dance steps. It's fight sequences, which can be looked at as dance steps.
Yeah, especially in a Zack Snyder movie.
Yeah. So, yeah, but the challenges were just one of the biggest challenges was that slanted stage that we had that we see in movie number two, because it was like we had to reset every time. It was not continuous, but when you watch it, it's like it's really continuous, which was challenging because we had to rehearse on a flat floor. And then when we shot, we had to actually really slide and we had to reset every time. It was like going up, they were not making it flat and then us going. But anyway, it was a whole thing. And it was also, you know, sometimes we had boxes sliding down, sometimes we had a pole. So every set was different and they had to be so organized, all the stunts and Zach to know, you know, what sequence should, what are we doing this one? I mean, anyway, it was a big deal.
I mean, I was watching that scene, you know, it's in the ship. I won't spoil too much about what's happening, but it is at like more than 45 degrees. And I was just thinking all the way through, how on earth with any amount of money do you film something like that? It looked, you know, it looked like you were all flying down, down at great speed.
We were, but just for shorter amount of times. I think it was broken into, I think if I'm not mistaken, 9 sequences.
Okay, wow.
I think it was 9, yeah.
And does that help the performance? Like when you've got something really difficult physically to contend with, to sort of keep it in the moment?
Yeah, of course. Yeah. And that's why also I insist that for me to do, I mean, I had my stunt double Mel who did a lot because you cannot achieve anything without them, even if you do all your stunt, because they have to set up the shot, they have to be present, they have to give you note, they have to look in the monitor. But for me, I insisted of doing everything I possibly could that they will allow me, because I wanted to find the physical exhaustion. Mm. I wanted to find what it does to me to be in that skin over and over and over. And Cora, Arthelius, has done that for way longer than I have done, you know, the stunts. So I wanted to put it in my body as much as I could.
Is there any difficulty finding time to rehearse when you're on such a big sort of Hollywood production in terms of like the character relationships and those nuances and finding the sort of the tiny moments in the subtext and the dialogue?
Yeah, it was at first I started rehearsing in January, and then January, February, March. So 3 months, 3 full months of just doing stunts. Mm. And it was mainly doing conditioning. I really wanted to learn how to hold the gun because I wanted to not make any mistake in that. I wanted to learn how to crawl with it, how to run, what I didn't want to look like. I haven't done that my whole life. And then I could only rehearse one fight sequence, which is the fight with Noble that we rehearsed over and over. That happens at the end of part one. But it's impossible to choreograph in advance 10 months of body of work. So and sometimes we had to shoot when we started filming. I couldn't be as much in the stunt room. So we had to build a rehearsal space on set. We had it, and then we had it on location when we were in Santa Clarita. And basically I had to hop out of filming and go rehearse with them, or come earlier in the morning before filming and go in between. Yeah. So we had to juggle that. Yeah.
Super intense.
Yeah.
Is there anything in particular you look for when you're getting a script sent to you, like deciding what, you know, maybe puts you off in a script, what excites you, what kinds of things, you know, provide an exciting challenge? I mean, obviously with this one, you've got Zack Snyder, you've got, you know, a massive epic. It's, you know, it's very compelling, but in a general sense, do you have any sort of things that are, you know, yeses and nos maybe?
I'm trying not to be that selective to begin with. I want to know about what the project is, and really, like, I think listen to my instinct and see if how and if it resonates to me in the moment. But for me, relationships in characters, the intimacy within themselves, the relationships with others is very, very important.
And maybe just one last bit of advice you could give to actors. I mean, you know, for instance, this one you've obviously did incredibly well in the auditioning phase. Any sort of tips in terms of how to let go and nail your auditions, maybe?
I mean, for me in general, don't give up. Mm. Don't give up on your dreams and keep pushing. It can be an easier road for certain than others, and a longer one for others. But I truly believe in not letting go if it truly comes from your heart. Mm. And if it truly comes from your heart is a very important point. It's like, why are you doing that? I had to ask myself that at some point. I was like, why? And because I was on autopilot, I didn't feel like I had the choice. I was truly led by my inspirations, and truly led by, I felt deeply like possessed by the need of, like, just being an artist. I needed to dance. I needed to interpret like feelings in one way or another. So acting is that. So I at some point, you forget why you're doing it, because like that's all you know. And at some point, like, I think it's important to remind yourself to reconsider, like, because you need to make changes, but to remind yourself basically why you do that, and really tap in with yourself. It's like, are you doing it for the right reasons? I truly believe that this is a craft and a job that are meant to be done for the right reasons.
Yes. An amazing advice to finish on. Massive congratulations again. I mean, you're a tour de force on screen, and you, action, emotion, everything. It's really good.
Oh, I appreciate it. Thank you so much.
Thanks.
Thank you.
There we have it. That was our episode on Rebel Moon with the amazing Zack Snyder, Sophie Batella, and Ed Skrein. I don't know what more you want from us right now. Do write in on a postcard. If you do want something different from this podcast, we are going to be doing a few more business of films coming up. We've all been very, very, very busy, but we will be doing those for you. But anything else you want, do reach out. filmmakerspodcast@gmail.com or go onto our Twitter page, filmmakerspod, or on our Instagram page, The Filmmakers Podcast. And share the love. Take a photo of the podcast you're listening to right now and stick it on Instagram and tag us, and we will share it. And we might even give you a thank out for it. A thank out? I might give you a thank out. Might give you a shout out as well. But listen, do go out there and do what you can to go make your films. It's a tough business, but you can rise up. And if you're lucky enough to do so, it is your duty to, you know the score. Until next Tuesday, when we have on another amazing guest, we will see you then, I imagine. For now, take care, everyone. Bye-bye.